Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And my world's collided a little bit in recent weeks as I heard someone refer to the GOP, the Republicans, the conservatives, as the gas and oil party, GOP. And that synced up nicely with a recent Florida Phoenix column from our very own Greg Pittman.
Well, I was trying to write about the fact that the Orlando Sentinel had this great story that said Florida candidates, Florida GOP candidates, were going on the campaign trail and touting the need for more and more offshore oil drilling, but at the same time having to say, oh, but we'll protect Florida's coast. Florida's coast will be fine. And it just reminded me of the time in 2009 when the legislature tried to allow offshore oil drilling in state waters, so like 3 miles from Florida. And they didn't quite get it through, but their big argument was, well, nobody will see it. So therefore, it's like it doesn't exist. And, you know, it'll be the curvature of the earth will be our salvation. And then following year, the BP oil spill happened and you know, a rig 100 miles away sent tar balls that wound up in Florida waters and coated beaches in 8 counties.
Yeah, it's a concept that the gas and oil party doesn't appreciate, you know, wildlife. Toxic fumes, oil spills, they don't adhere to political boundaries. You know, they go here, there, and everywhere. And I thought even the general of the war on wildlife and the war against nature, Donald Trump, had federally outlawed or reinstated a longstanding outlaw against drilling in Florida waters.
Well, he issued an executive order, probably signed it with that Sharpie he used to change the course of the hurricane. And those are just as good as, you know, the next president. So,
okay, so that was an executive order. Okay.
It was an executive order. So it doesn't hold the force of you know, law. Congress passing a law, which Florida's delegation and, you know, God bless them, Republican and Democrat have both been pushing for this law to get passed to make the moratorium on drilling near Florida concrete. And they haven't been able to get that through because, of course, the oil and gas industry has lots and lots and lots of money to spread around for campaign contributions. You know, everybody's complaining about high gas prices. Meanwhile, the oil and gas companies are recording record profits right now.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the classic tactic of the gas and oil party. You know, when gas prices are high, they scream that now is not the time to go to clean energy. Now is the time to drill here, drill more, drill now, drill everything.
Drill, baby, drill.
And then when gas prices are low, they say, see, isn't everything working perfectly? Isn't everything wonderful? To me, a crisis is the absolute, well, a crisis is not the best time to do anything. The best time to do something is before it's a crisis, right?
Exactly.
But since this transition to clean energy by the United States should have been made, say, oh, Carter-ish, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and people were aware of this. You know, don't let anyone in the gas and oil party or with the petrochemical industry try and tell you that this is something that no one expected to come along, and this is all very surprising, and we didn't really know, the science wasn't there. Now, 40, 50 years ago, we all knew we were, we didn't all know it, but people knew we were heading towards this cliff and decided to push the gas pedal down instead of lay on the brakes. Right, exactly. So another wonderful column from Craig there at floridaphoenix.com. Now, we want to thank, again, Visit Sarasota, our longtime sponsor, for helping present the podcast. And I've got an interesting link down in the show notes for fish markets. Now, some people, of course, like to go to fish restaurants, and some people like to fish themselves. But kind of that middle ground is the people who want to go and buy their fish, but cook it at home. And Sarasota has a wonderful group of fish markets. You've got Big Water Fish Market on Siesta Key, Octopus Salad. I would be interested in trying that. They've got a great grouper sandwich, and it has been a long time, Greg, since I have had a grouper sandwich. Walt's Fish Market in Sarasota since 1940s. Island Court Seafood. Now, this is in the Inglewood area. This is an interesting one. It's a little spot on Manasota Key. Fresh fish caught daily by their local fishermen. It's a historic fishing town, so it's got kind of this old Florida charm. You can walk out in the docks and see the fishing boats. I've got a list, too, of these fish markets in Sarasota and a number of others down in the show notes. Visit Sarasota, Windstormproducts.com. And also want to thank Windstormproducts.com. Now, this is the company we've been telling you about, Florida company, small company that has developed into the largest online retailer in the world for hurricane hardware. That's the bolts and the screws and the wig nuts, but also the fastening tools and drill bits, all the stuff that helps you secure your home or business from hurricane wind damage. That whether you've got masonry, concrete, sidewalks, stucco, wood, this is for heavy duty. You know, you've got a business and all kind of furniture out on sidewalks and you need that stuff secured. The experts at windstormproducts.com can help you. They've been in business a long time doing this. And what I love especially, you can call them and get the right product for your job. If you're somewhere between a do-it-yourselfer and just call and have someone else do it, Windstorm Products is there to help. They've got an 800 number right on the website. If you know a little but not a lot, you want to save money and you can do some of these projects with the expertise of the folks at windstormproducts.com. This week's guest is Jamin Wells, and Jamin is a professor and researcher at the University of West Florida.
He's going to talk to us about a very important topic, which is the Klan in Florida, the Ku Klux Klan. The UWF got possession of a bunch of records detailing sort of the life and times of the Ku Klux Klan in Pensacola, and it just really gives us a window on how this terrorist organization operated there.
All right. Interesting stuff. A difficult, I'd say, chapter, but it's more than a chapter of Florida's history that we're going to explore in greater detail here. Looking forward to this.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about how the University of West Florida came into possession of these documents that sort of give us a window on how the Klan operated in Florida.
Sure. So University of West Florida operates what was called the T.T. Wentworth State Museum, and now it is the Pensacola Museum of History at the University of West Florida. It has been renamed as a consequence of these documents coming to light. The foundation of that museum was this enormous collection of material that was donated by T.T. Wentworth Jr., a well-known Pensacola booster. He was described as Mr. History, a really avid collector in the 1980s. And when he passed and his family, donations kept coming in from the Wentworth family. And this particular set of documents was part of about 80 boxes of material that officially came into the archive in November of 2019. Hmm. And it was from the estate of T.T. Wentworth's daughter-in-law, who lived in Mr. Wentworth's home. And they were selling the home and they were emptying out the last vestiges of what was in there. And so this trove of documents, a little over 200 in this particular collection, wow, came in to the archives and officially became part of the collection in late 2019.
How long did it take for researchers to go through this box of materials and realize that a completely different picture of who T.T. Wentworth was and how he should be remembered was unfolding in front of their very eyes?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And part of the work that, you know, I came into this project in July, August of 2020, when these documents came to light publicly in discussions about what to do with Pensacola's Confederate monument. And knowledge these documents were made public by a well-known local historian here. As that came to light, the university brought me in and some others to say, like, what do we have here? And how do we make this publicly accessible? And so we went through over about a year. We scanned all the documents. I went into the collection and looked deep back into all those materials that have come into the university, into the archive over the years. And eventually, all told, we found 265 documents. And we scanned all of the documents except those that were published. And of course, there's a number of material culture objects. So there's about 32 robes. There's 37 hoods. They actually have,
oh my gosh,
The crosses. It's chilling to see this. You can still see they have the firecrackers still embedded in the crosses. And all the robes and even the lectern, where we know that T.T. Wentworth, in his role as Exalted Cyclops, as it was called in the 1920s, spoke from that lectern. And we know what he was saying because we have those documents, right? Mm. And so it's really chilling to see that all that material was found in the early 70s when they were renovating this hall in downtown Pensacola that was a meeting hall for lots of groups, including the Klan. And so as they were taking apart, the story was told that a secret room was found, and in the secret room were 500 moldering Klan robes that were found, and those were brought into the predecessor of the historic trust, which now operates the museum. And so it's a convoluted local history. Here is a very convoluted and complex story that led to this. The University of West Florida Historic Trust operating a lot of these entities. So
that's incredible. I mean, just that there was so much. What did you learn from this about sort of the day-to-day activities of the Klan and about how they recruited people to join?
A lot of scholars have written about this, and we have this popular notion of the Klan, which is often rooted in like the 1950s and 60s, mm-hmm. Against the civil rights movement. And then also right after the Civil War, during that reconstruction, that reassertion of white supremacy across the Confederacy. The second Klan really started in 1915. Its peak was 1921 to the late 1920s, and kind of really kind of went underground. And evaporated more or less during the Great Depression in World War II. The second Klan was different. It was a lot more mainstream. It was most powerful, and its largest concentration of Klansmen were in the Midwest and the West, which not, you know, it's common in the South. It was a very widespread fraternal organization, which used the iconography of the Reconstruction Klan, which still relied on these ideas of white supremacy, Protestant nationalism, and that appealed to a lot of people in the 1920s. This is after World War One.
Appeals to a lot of people in the 2020s.
Yeah,
true.
It appears so. So this is a time of retrenchment. You know, there was a Red Summer where there were race riots in dozens of American cities. This is a period of the first Red Scare and fear of communism. And this is a time when we have one of the most restrictive immigration laws in American history comes in, and they're literally trying to dictate policy to bring the country back to how it had been before these new waves of immigration had transformed the American country. So it's a period that kind of resonates with right now in some really fascinating ways, and to parts and others.
Who were the people in the Klan? Were they like business leaders, or were they like farmers from rural areas, or who was it?
Yeah. So what's unique about this collection is that we have ledger books with membership rosters. And we also have, we know about 487 robes were ordered by T.T. Wentworth, and we know the person and their robe number, and we can go to the collection and see the robes and the number, so we can put robes to people,
that's incredible.
It's just incredible. Yeah, it's incredible. You got to kind of I got to disassociate myself from it and try to be objective on this as I go into it. Otherwise, it's really upsetting to see this material. We have these ledgers so we can look at the material. We spend a year really analyzing and looking up these folks. Who are these individuals? What were they doing? What were their occupations? Were they married? Were they single? What can we identify about them? Mm-hmm. And we have a pretty good picture. In the beginning, it was primarily lower middle class is probably the best way to describe that. There were some professionals early on, but when the Klan initially pitched itself, I mean, the National Klan Office hired an advertising company because they really were struggling to grow. So they literally did mass marketing.
Wow.
And sent out 1,000 of these advertising folks around the country. One of those people came through Pensacola and recruited folks. So they had this recruiting script, this national program. And so early on, they focus on recruiting from fraternal organizations. You might be familiar with, you know, one of the famous 20s books is Babbitt, who's just known as this joiner. He joins everything. This great, he joins every organization. And so a lot of folks would join in. They went to these fraternal organizations and got folks to join. They went to, you know, Protestant churches and brought folks into this. So there was a rapid growth in membership, but very quickly, it seems like the professional folks in Pensacola left for the most part. Many of them left. And so by the end, T.T. Wentworth actually complains to the state leadership that we only have laborers left and we can't do what we're supposed to do as Klansmen is something he says in one of his letters. So the membership sort of evolves. Now, the Second Klan is a Ponzi scheme. Like, a lot of historians have looked at this. Economists have looked at this. And this was multi-level marketing.
Wow.
And, yeah. And so there was big money to be made, especially at the national level, because it all floated up. Membership fees, it's the equivalent. The peak year in Pensacola, they bring in what is would today be about $83,000 in fees and membership dues mm-hmm. in a year. So we have the financial records as well. So in terms of these documents, you know, the ledger is fascinating. Those are relatively common across the country. That we have some financial records is unique, but not particularly unique. But the correspondence we have, the minute meetings, really is unique, and it offers what is really an unparalleled view of the inner workings of a Klan during this time, especially in the Deep South, right? Especially in the Deep South. So we
What of those inner workings surprised you when you read, like, oh my God, I can't believe it was like this or they did that? You know, what stands out as particularly revealing about, you know, like Craig was mentioning, that day-to-day, those inner workings, how the Klan functioned as you know, this, you know, fraternal organization, you know, the way you've described it.
Yeah. So what we see is incredible infighting, you know, and jockeying for power and accusations of how this is going. Why are people joining us? What are their motives and their ends? And so T.T. Wentworth, who about a month or two after he becomes the youngest county commissioner in Florida history at that point, he was elected at 21, steps into the office at 22. About a month after, we know those first, you know, the Klan's getting started in Pensacola. And I don't know the exact date he joined, but he's in it from basically the beginning. So he joins, he's reelected. And then he would later, at the end of the decade, be elected to the county tax collector for a dozen years. And so this, he's communicating on a regular basis with the governor, with state leaders. And his correspondence with related to the Klan continues into 1941, when he gets a letter from Orlando asking for a credential for their new police chief, who said that he was part of the Klan in Pensacola. And so that is the last letter I have up to 1941. Because I've gone through, like, personally tens of thousands of his correspondence, and the man saved everything, it was clear how he would mark his correspondence if he responded to things or not. And it does not appear like he responded to that message, but he definitely received the letter and kept it.
I think something that surprises me still, because this was not the history I was taught. You know, the history I was taught is very clandestine, very secret. You know, no one wanted to be known that they were really in the Klan because they were ashamed of it. That is not the reality of the situation. This appears to have been very open. Everyone knew, you know, who was in the Klan, public officials in the Klan. They talk about Klan business in broad daylight, and, you know, they seem to operate as if they were the Elks Club. You know, this is not, you know, a secret society. It seems very open to me. And I think, you know, that surprises me, and I think would surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, it was the biggest open secret. They're advertising meetings and lectures in the newspapers, literally. So they're getting they're writing letters to the newspaper. And it's an open secret that T.T. Wentworth was involved in it. And I know that because community letters, I have a set of about 9 letters. And all of these documents, if you go to the website, you can look at all these documents. They're all scanned and available for folks to look at themselves if you want to actually see this. So 9 letters sent to the Klan, a few of them directed, literally mailed to T.T. Wentworth, saying, we hear what the Klan, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing all these letters, but we know what the Klan does. We have these immoral people, or we have this biracial couple, or we have this other issue, quote unquote. Can you come and do something about it? We need the Klan to do something about it. In the 1920s, the Klan acted as sort of this moral police. And this is the time of prohibition. This is the time of a real growth in evangelical Christianity. And so there is this moral policing element that the Klan is doing. And we see that at our local level. And we see what neighborhoods and what issues people are directing at Pensacola's Klan to do this.
Did I read right that they actually went into the churches trying to recruit people?
Yep. This was a national, this is a common recruiting technique. And so they would show up in at a local church, often at like a Wednesday night meeting, something along those lines. And we have some really vivid descriptions of what it looked like. It was quite dramatic. They would enter, a dozen, you know, robed Klansmen would come in, and sometimes they would speak to the gathering. We know in a few cases here locally that the pastor was a member. So, you know, we're in cahoots. And another, we know that they're dressing in the front room and undressing. So everyone knew what was going on. You know, it was the biggest open secret about who was involved here, but it was dramatic, you know, and there were secret handshakes and secret rituals. And it was part of this interest in these fraternal organizations, the sense of belonging that a lot of people flock to. But Pensacola is unique in some ways too, that we get this fascinating picture of how it actually operated, what was driving people to do it, who are they communicating, how is this working? But what really stood out to me is the opposition that the Klan in Pensacola faced. Pensacola always has had a strong Catholic component. It's a port town. And so it's always, you know, been closer to its commercial connections outside the South than the Deep South for much of its history, till the railroads came in and the population dynamics changed. But there was a powerful traditional Catholic presence, a strong newer immigrant presence, and they were fiercely contested. T.T. Wentworth was claimed to have been stabbed. There were not quite gunfights, but pistols were brandished and shot into the air as people tried to attack Wentworth. His businesses were boycotted. He had a magazine he had to sell, he claimed, because of the boycott he faced by the Knights of Columbus, he claimed, were his and the Klan's arch enemies in the streets of Pensacola. And so this is in their internal documents. This is in a history he wrote of the Klan. And this is in the newspapers as well. And so it's triangulated in a whole bunch of different ways.
You mentioned about the police chief from Orlando. Were there members of law enforcement that were active members of the Klan?
There were a few. We know a constable that was elected was a Klansman in the 20s. Mm-hmm. The police roster is changing a lot at this time, so we haven't verified all the names just yet. But that said, one of the most maybe surprising and maybe chilling documents that came to light were three cards that granted T.T. Wentworth police powers in the city.
Holy cow.
It was the 3 years that he was the exalted Cyclops, like chapter president of the local Klan. So those are police powers. So those powers, I looked in, what does that mean, right? Mm. And so about 100-150, and they would be given to like night watchmen, folks like that who would need to have some version of police powers. But he had those cards. He saved them. I have no idea how he used them. I have no record of him bringing people to the police department from the police records I have from that time. But we can only imagine how those could have been deployed around town.
Who grants that authority? Is it like the mayor or the city council or someone? I mean, who gives such a card?
It was the police commissioner. So the former governor was a city commission. So there were three commissioners, and one of those commissioners was over the police department, and he would be the one to grant it. They were kind of mired in controversy about who gets these things. What does it mean? Could you carry a gun or not? And allowed you to carry a gun, right? So there's, you had to register your revolver and things of this nature. So, you know, it's caught up in some gun control issues as well at this time. It was in controversy, and they eventually, I think, basically did away with it by the 30s. So it's a little hard to track that. But
you mentioned the moral policing that they kind of role they took on themselves. Obviously, that is totally extrajudicial. They have no authority or legal power to do such things. What actions did they take beyond recruitment and holding meetings and the theatrics of dressing up in the costumes. What did they do, you know, to try and shape society, I guess, yeah, in their, you know, vision?
So there's a few things we can document and a few things that we can maybe infer from what went on nearby. So the documentation is thin. Part of that is the newspapers. There were two daily newspapers at this time. Only one survives. And the one that doesn't survive was, we know from the few issues we have and how it's discussed, was vehemently anti-Klan. So much so that a cross was burned in the editor's front yard during this time. So we know that they're burning crosses and intimidating. The Pensacola Klan bursts onto the national scene in July 1921, which was pretty early nationally, and became sort of this not national example of how the Second Klan wasn't just this white fraternal organization, as they were saying. It was the heir to the First Klan, right? That it had these violent tendencies. And in that July 1921, the Pensacola Klan showed up for the first time on the streets of Pensacola in their robes and warned out, threatened a restaurant owner for being un-American. And this was a 27-year-old Greek restaurant owner. He was had only been in the country about 10 years, and he was warned out, which we don't have examples that documented in the so far that show beatings or things of that nature. Yeah. But keep in mind that the record is thin of this time, and that one of the primary collections we have for understanding Pensacola in the 20th century is the documents that T.T. Wentworth collected and put in his museum. So it potentially it's a pretty biased source base that we have left.
Yeah.
What does warned out mean when you say they warned him out?
It was threatened. He was threatened to leave or else something bad would happen. So these Klansmen, they pull up in front of this man's cafe. They walk in hooded. They walk past the police captain who's sitting there, and they give him a note silently. And it says, "You've been doing un-American things, and you need to leave in the next train. Sign the KKK."
Yikes.
Yeah, well, the Klan, the story went that the Klan hadn't been active in Pensacola. He looked at this and just folded up, put it in his pocket. These people walk out, keeps talking to the police captain. The police captain claimed, although he was suspended for a bit, that he thought it was this Greek fraternal organization playing some sort of joke. But what came to light later is that there were several African-American customers in the museum, in the restaurant at the time. Mm-hmm. And after the Klan left, they told the restaurant owner, his name is Lotrus, Chris Lotrus, that, "Hey, I know who those people are. We know who those people, those are bad people." And kind of told them what it was. And then the next day, Lotrus went to Mobile for a period of time and left town. So again, it's this extra legal threatening of violence and perceived violence.
Was there a local network of Klan chapters in there? Like, did Panama City have one? Did Tallahassee have one? Did Dothan have one? Did they communicate, or was this Pensacola chapter kind of an outlier in a sense?
No, there was a strong statewide network. They had statewide meetings. They had legislative caucuses about preparing for each legislative session. The Pensacola Klan was officially chartered as Escambia Klan number 57, I believe. So it's the 57th chapter in the state of Florida.
Oh, my word.
A very hierarchical. The 54th or so was in Millen. And, the center was in Tallahassee with the statewide leader there. Then there was a regional. It was a very hierarchical system. Again, this is sort of a Ponzi scheme set up to push funds up. And so they're in near daily communication during election season, because they were very much about using politics to shape. And, you know, we see that nationally with this immigration restriction. We see laws focusing on prayer in school, about school textbooks and what can be taught in schools. They're very focused on education matters. And so we see a lot of discussion on this. And so not only are they trying to influence legislature, and they're working in concert across the state, and that comes to light through these documents, but they're also playing a role in local and state elections. So we have a Klansman from Escambia County who is in the elected to the Florida Senate, the Florida representatives. We have commissioners and tax assessors, and we have Klansmen working at working as poll watchers during a number of elections. So we see them at every part of the kind of electoral process, trying to shape that.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. What finally led to the decline and downfall of the second Klan?
Well, it's you know, the Pensacola story ties in with the national story. And so these claims of temperance and moral purity, there were a number of scandals of the national leaders that suggested that what they were saying was not how they were living, is probably the best way to put it. So
what were they, partying with booze and things like that? Or?
Yes. A lot of corruption. There was this kind of scandalous murder case in Indiana. I don't read that much fiction because the nonfiction is just so utterly out of this world, you wouldn't even believe it, right? Mm-hmm. This applies to the 20s in the Klan. So there's a lot of national scandals. Some historians argue that what the Klan wanted, they kind of achieved legislatively by the late 1920s with sort of, you know, we have the Scopes trial, you know, about it's, you know, illegal to teach evolution is sort of upheld. We have this anti-immigration act. We have a lot of laws are passed that kind of the things, a lot of the things that the Klan was going for, they got. Jim Crow is still very deeply entrenched and embedded. So you have these national scandals, you have these legislative victories, and you also have the Great Depression, which seems to kind of put the lid on a lot of Klan activity. It seems in Pensacola, it was the height of about 500 due-paying members. And we know we have the robes in 1925. By 1927, there's about 150 members, and the membership had changed. T.T. Wentworth, who's kind of carrying the flag when everyone around the country is abandoning the Klan, he is elected to this tax collector position. And it seems it sort of fizzles out, kind of like he was kind of keeping it together. I have that appearance. That said, it probably continued ad hoc for a while. I think those clans, there's oral histories and family stories of clan robes being seen in the county into the 1930s. And of course, the Klan would reemerge in Escambia County after during the Civil Rights Movement.
Did Wentworth use his position as the tax collector to amass property from Black voters? Is there any evidence of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And throughout this research process, we've worked closely with Wentworth Family Foundation and heirs, and they were part of the conversation with us, and we kept them. And we had this community advisory group of local historians and stakeholders from across the political and historic spectrum. Kind of, we all just sat down, and this is, you know, this took place during Zoom and COVID and everything, and Hurricane Sally hit us and all that. So we probably spent 20, 30 hours on Zoom together working through this report. We went through as a group line by line to get lots of perspectives. And one of the things that everyone wants to know is, how did he amass his wealth? Because he died a multimillionaire in the 1980s. We know in 1919, he's, you know, doesn't have a lot of money. His whole estate is worth today maybe $30,000, $30,000, $40,000. By the time he's, you know, deep in his tax collector role, he has the equivalent of $1 million today in assets. And almost all of that's in property. Who was he targeting? Well, we went through and pulled all the deeds, which is always a fun time, and trying to figure out what properties is he buying, who is he doing it. So we're deep trying to suss that out. This is a complicated time in Florida history. They changed some of the laws about tax sales and made it a lot easier to sell property that had their tax bill due, so to speak. So this is after the Florida land boom. There's a lot of property that no one's paying taxes on. And so this law gets passed, makes it very easy to sell this tax due land. And Wentworth buys a lot of property. You know, he's buying two dozen parcels in the county in a 2-year period. He gets a decent salary. Whenever, you know, the Great Depression hits, he's making a really good salary. So he's gobbling up property. And that property would really come in handy when Pensacola is booming after World War II. And he made a lot of money as a real estate appraiser and broker and owner. Hmm. So the short answer, Craig, is that I don't know yet, and we're looking.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, which brings up another point. I mean, this is a lot of documentation. You're not done with this material. What else are you continuing to research, and what questions are you still trying? Other questions are you still trying to answer from this material?
Yeah. So I'm very interested in the wealth, and also the family is very interested in how can we use this knowledge to help create a better future. And so they have a service of acknowledgement and lament, and I know they're working to do something with this knowledge. And that's really exciting to see this history, which is 100 years old, being put into action and thinking about legacies. The work certainly continues, but I'm really interested in how T.T. Wentworth shaped what we know, Pensacola, Escambia County, Northwest Florida, what we know about, think we know about ourselves and the stories that are told. He is described as Mr. History. He sort of created the script, opened the museum on what is the story of Pensacola, America's first settlement. And if you go back to how all that language was first laid out by T.T. Wentworth, and he played a role shaping Florida Historical Society. He played a role nationally in conversations about the past. So how did he shape the stories? And we know that he framed it up as this is the story of the first white settlement. And it was very explicitly this perspective. So I'm really interested in how he shaped memory and knowledge and kind of civic awareness. And we see that going on, you know, this debate over the past, literally in the newspaper yesterday in Pensacola, as the police department's looking at a badge redesign, because of course their badge until this redesign included the Confederate battle flag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Interesting. The past has never passed. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not. Jamin Wells is a professor at the University of West Florida, working through this incredible archive of material from T.T. Wentworth that is revealing of deep and widespread Klan activity in Pensacola. Thank you so much for your time and the insight you've shared with us today, Jamin.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
This has been great. Thanks.
As I was mentioning in the episode, Craig, it is just astounding to me how ordinary, commonplace, regular, mainstream, Main Street, Elks Club, Booster Club, you know, that the Klan was during this period. It just is astonishing to me.
Well, you know, they talk about the banality of evil, and there's a perfect example of it, you know, of people who treated going to Klan meetings as if they were going to the Rotary Club lunch.
Yeah.
You know, oh, and by the way, Owen, we're bringing a cross this weekend. So, you know, make sure you bring matches.
Yeah. Just boy. Well, if this sort of history interests you, I have another subject you may find very intriguing, and that is at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Petersburg, Florida, one of my favorite places in the state. New exhibition opening September 3rd. It opened September 3rd and runs through January 8th. It's Black Pioneers, Legacy in the American West. This is an exploration of the path of Black history in the West with a timeline of original pictorial quilts. So the story is essentially told through quilts, and these colorful, richly detailed works of art chronicle the arrival of Africans in the American West as far back as 1528, all the way through the civil rights movement, bringing to life forgotten stories of lesser known chapters in our shared history. So when we think about, you know, the history of the Klan in Florida, or whether it's the history of Black people in the American West, there is so much about American history as it relates to race that has been covered up, overlooked, misinterpreted. And this is just one more example of trying to bring that into a more accurate context. It is Black Pioneers, Legacy in the American West, an exhibition of pictorial quilts dating back hundreds of years, the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art. And this episode, Craig, if people are interested in learning more about this history, kind of tangentially, our Stetson Kennedy episode, yes, our episode on America's Most Racist Sheriff. Jamin talked about that immigration law. We actually brought that up with Patty League on our Greek Tarpon Springs episode, and how immigration in America from, yes, Eastern Europe was really curtailed because of this period in the 19-teens. Immigration policy heavily favored Northwestern Europe and Protestant. So, you know, this is a topic we've hit on a number of times before, which goes to show how, you know, how deeply this all ran through the state's history.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's even mentioned in our episode on oranges and the orange industry, citrus industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
But wait, we can't talk about critical race theory. Oh, never mind. Cancel everything.
Yeah. And in all honesty, these are critical race theory topics. You know, this is the history that needs to be shared and remembered and placed on at least an equal footing with the history that has been told, which is largely a white nationalist flag waving. Everything's great here. America's ideals. All men are created equal. That's part of it. This is another part, and this is the other half that hasn't been told, so to speak. And one of the things that we both take a great deal of pride in sharing on this episode. And welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.